five kinds of nays that we made this coming summer. Put trout in them and feed them. And put trout in here. That's easy. 6 months, 8 months, and do this. How long have we put half the trout in? Yeah, they were about edible size in about 4 months. Here's a different proposition. Here we have the trout in their food. So if you consider that swamp to be their food, and every minute of the day as a tadpole making the mistake of swimming out of the grass into this clear water. I believe that this allows the fish to grow, help the fish. And the amount of this we can do is pretty well unlimited, except the only thing that nobody knows is how much of the swamp do you lose to the deeps, what proportion of the deeps of swamp. Anyone like to make a bias guess? Is it a tadpole travel hour or what sort of criteria could you apply? Yes, you've got to have a marsh there, but not so much for fish to get in. But it's probably some optimum distance between canals. And I think you'd be fairly safe to say between 5 and 8 times swamp to canal width would keep the canal pretty well supplied. I think if you start to shorten it much on that, it may be you're not getting optimal growth or sustainable. I shelved it out here because we eventually started to get the weight in there and stay over there. I've intended to put Echium all the way along. We stuck the little pieces in and hit the ground last year. Only a dozen or so went. Along the edge of the trout here. Yeah, it's a very good insect. And also, it's control and it's a fit introduction to it. There are a great many new ones out and they are starting to grow. There's no problem. But you cut them off and stick them in inside. Well, we've got the backhoe guy to do it. He drove the circle out with his backhoe. Could have drive the circle and backed off and scooped out and put up. He enjoyed doing it. First time in his life. But anyone who employed him in a productive capacity, he could have been managed backhoes all his life and he could have all he thought he was doing was destroying. But he enjoyed this job so much. And it gave him his head a bit too. We made the island. Actually, that last one we called Davin Island, that's his name. He's dead. He died on his backhoe last year. After he dug all this. We were going to bring him back to do some more work. But he died on it. Anyhow, he's got his little island. But a few things going on the island too. They are basically there for the duck milk profit, basically. But, you know, it's nice to have lots of places in the cope environment where it's difficult for people, or if possible, to make it impossible for them. But a lot of other things want refuge. For instance, we look after the copperhead snakes up here. Could you look on copperhead snakes as an income source? I used to earn a huge income from them. How did I earn it? I used to milk 400 a year, and that's a lot of money. Now I just like them and I don't want anyone to kill them. So I'd like to put places where they can live and people can't get them. You can make a good income from venom sales. If you ever buy a bass bait nut for the island, you can make it from target bait. Good luck to you. Good luck to you. there were 36 of us collected the beds for the CSIRO in the early Adjuvenin studies. 34 died of snake bite. Now, you'll have to get through a hole in the fence there, some of you know where to go, and walk around there, unless you're feeling very good. What I thought might interest you here is the country, not in its growing, but in its dead state. This is just on the way here. And it died down, some of the young plants. The current plant of that one. When it dies down, there's nothing on the ground. Basically bare ground and pretty good quality. This plant has a very large diameter. So that's the die down profile of the country. What that sort of suggests to you. Yeah, the grass control and living mulch with a good production. Good production of high potash mulch. So where would you like to see it? Well, as long as you didn't disturb the bloody stuff, it's ideal around the periphery, just outside the drip line of the fruit trees for grass control and also for potash production. And you couldn't beat it for good dirt. It really is lovely stuff, eh? So, by 2 years, you can't have taken out that much grass. It's perennial. It's a die-down perennial. This year it died down last week. This year we had forest erosion. This year. So here's another one here. You can see it's a very young one. But I think it's interesting to have a look at the plants all season to make sure. Why is such a good one? So you walk in, weren't going to buy the money, so you were going to stand back over there. What about in the leaf cut? rain that started to dry up early in the summer and didn't reflood till the autumn, which killed the eels. So there was no eels. Now, well, the idea. And there's our marvellous example of throwing away maybe $4 million to gain maybe $150. Now this is a downstream eel trap. Doesn't look like it because we haven't made it. The eel was coming in. We'll put an overfall just there so the swamp goes up the foot and falls over. We'll put an intake here with a screen on top, go down under a wall and then close away. So the eels can come out on migration, over the board, fall into here, this will be netted over, so the crows won't get it. The water goes through and out, but of course the eels must stay, which is the very simplest way to harvest your eels. At the end of your system, a fall over trap with a screen out there. To get the elvers back up, you have to put a small mix overflow of fresh water down a nylon carpet or something that they can wriggle up. Other side of the nylon carpet, which is how they get them in Ireland. And as you always get millions more elvers than you need, you can sell most of your elvers. So they're very saleable too. Both ways, upstream and downstream. The little fellas are getting through at the rate we want to restock them. The big guys will take all of them because they all go to sea. We don't let any go to sea from here. Up eels going to sea. Turn into any fresh water. And there's always many billions of them that every stream gets overstocked. We don't know what sort of growth we'll get out of them. If we could grow them at the rate the Japanese grow them, about 50,000. Now, there's no reason why blueberries should interfere with the eels. It's an additive product. If I was really hungry for money, that's what I would be doing here. It's so we started the run again. But the swamp wouldn't dry out. And in 3 years' time, you get your first out migration, and from then, though, you get it every year. Always have. Been millions of ducks and millions of eels grow up together in the swamp over the millennia. Yeah, and all the markers work as well for the eels as for the trout. Trout and eels go together fairly well. Broadly speaking, they don't interfere much in their nutrients. They eat different. Also slight. Some trout eat some eels, some eels eat some trout. It's not a big deal. It is much higher than either on their own. Because of their low trophic efficiency, you know, but we rather recommend they stock, say, rainbow trout. But then you get anything where you would be getting it, in addition to it. But the drain down system here is not sensitive. It's going to wipe out the fish periodically. I wouldn't put eels in the water. But if you've got eels, it just does, you know, excellent things to go. As it is on those hills up there, you have a. If you look at the trees, I'll tell you the story. You have a system. You have this southwest bit of flowing, and you have a easterly come streaming in from the sea. Now, forget the southwest bit. Easterly does this, and that's not wind pruned at all. What is it? Salt pruned, and therefore it's all summer. If the easterly blew only during the winter, we wouldn't see any flagging of that much at all. But summer. Summer will kill, you can see the outside of, say, even of those fine, the dead ones on the easterly side. Periodically, the summer easterly will kill even the box corn. Get catastrophic easterly brain for 3 weeks in summer. And you can self-crystallize it out on cloth and clotheslines and on your beard when you're walking. And that's what causes all the damage. So as far as growing trees is concerned, you need a professional lot of windbreaks. Tides break them fairly well. They wind around about 5 times high. No more than probably 300 or 400 feet apart across here as we go now. And these are some native trees, some blackwoods, and there's a lot of leatherwoods in these things for bees. The rest of it is really simple. It's flowering species for bees. Where? Ripped up there. Nick ripped it up to put those extra pines in it. Oh, the other one, the property keepers of the town are putting in a bit of wheat on the other one later in the year. Property is basically 2 kilometres, total about 40 acres, divided by 2 roadstone bridges, which that is one, and we've made this road connection across between the swamp, and this is another, and that's the wall of the volcano you see, of which the nut is the core, and we are in the floor. It's the Miocene system, all of the northwest coast. You see different cores and different headlands. There's one that's windier, and we can count the number of flows, twin rivers. They've all developed sort of crevices and soils and the forest. The dream, this is not one. Although it's been a good grazing land all the time, and we paid $200 an acre for it, which is a pretty good price for it in this condition. As an aquatic system, however, it's ideal. More aquatic than it is. I don't know how many acres we have. Probably got 50 acres of here. And that would be some production. The peat is very thick on the swamp. It's about that thick. It's a hot, excessive amount of peat. As a peat mine alone, of course, you know, we're supported. So as we go, you take up the peat and you return maybe 4 inches to the position. It's only about 4 inches of peat every day. Look at it from all sorts of points of view. One of the things you've got to look at closely is what I call earth resources. And as you're mucking around with a bulldozer, you'll see several things. In this bay, it's not very important. And it's greater than that, in my opinion. And second part is that respect. Now, there are very few places in the world you can get fight where you don't have to see. You find an old place up on that road. I bet you couldn't guess why they developed it. It wasn't to fight the Air Force or any fire. It was to make Christmas. And it's a famous, it's a famous pit in Australia. The freight from that pit has been shipped all over Australia, and the pits is made from a silk canyon. And people will drive anywhere or buy it, pay any price for it. Now, this way is a streamer bag. You can sell that bag at never let it dry out because it's very hard to reconstitute it. We found expensive deposits. Therefore, if you're looking at the whole of that flat as a sort of either a clay mine or, you know, make your own mine go. And in a case, in our case, of course, we are going to put it up. And when we put it up, we'll crash the cover of our station. We have a short sale to the education department, to the public, or to any station. It's possible, if you let a bulldozer driver loose, to take resources worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and destroy them. If you mix it with apple topsoil, if you get too much peat in it, it doesn't know it's there, it doesn't know it's there. So when you are moving soil, never leave the driver alone for a minute. There's a small mountain up there I put up on road gravel. I don't know how many cubic metres of it. That little mound there covered with vegetation with peat. Put a bit of this up for a friend. I'm going to take it down and peel it out later. But we discovered very large deposits of clay laid down under anaerobic conditions. It's very high quality. In fact, the whole of the floor of the swamp is made out of, on top of it, 6 feet. So, as far as your clients are concerned, you better look at those earth resources first. A lot of people... found it and took it to the plotters and had it tried and had them give me their opinions on it. The opinion was they wanted to buy as much of it as I could.
It's very different from normal because
you're buying. Yeah, it's actually bluer than this before it oxidized. It's right down under the... It is. Better clay than that up here. So then we did a bit of a spot around for it. Then we looked at the feet early on, didn't we, and we poured some time for it and the feet holes and judged the feet depth. And we knew we had this property paid for long before we bought it. What can you say? One clay picture, we say. A tiny clay picture. 1 acre of peat. If you don't see that, 4 acres of eel, you pay for it 10 times over every year. You should use your eyes. And then a few tests. You've got to test a few things. I told you about testing water. And then you know where you are. We know where you are. Later on, I was told the biggest publication for permission to use a cricket pitch out of this hole. I said, oh, sure, go for the ride. Why do you ask? I said, well, our pitch is 80 years old or something. Some of the old timers told us where we got it. I said, it's the best cricket pitch material in Australia. It's been made, most cricket pitch in Australia have been made out of this hole. It's incredibly good. So you can go and look at it. It's a shallow pond up here on the road. Down a lot of pitches and all these civilians here. Pretty good place. Life is pretty weird. thing we can get off the chip, we've got. We've got it all off the chip, I think. We've got the cover. The third system of growing fish we're developing here.
Fish stocks will go
in that pond. And that's where the fish will live. In this pond and subsequent ponds uphill, and ponds possibly either side, and a pond this side and that side, we'll be using for a fish forage species. Expect that will be pretty successful, I believe. The stock that is pretty high density, providing we've got enough food for them. So we'll be trying out this system over here. The other way to do it is we'll see them in a minute, fairly deep drains along here, but we turn them into swale drains successively. We think we'll over deepen them and turn parts of them into long ponds. Stock those invertebrates and a flow down system. Some of the fish we can stock in here, for instance, the Lapsius cetinearta, is an excellent forage fish and tries to run to sea. And largely, a lot will succeed in getting to sea if we put up the stream. And it spawns just at the mouth of the sea and then runs back. So that means we expect them to have to go from the high waters right through the whole trout population on the way down, and right through them on the way back, so, and the young ones have to come back too. So if we set up the Atenuata's population isolated from the trout, then we should see a nice lot of food flowing through the trout system. We can link all of them. And some of them, see, the idea is trout shouldn't be able to get at these Atenuata's. You get an outfall pipe. Galaxius cretaceous carries on the same migration, and there's a Galaxius in these swamps that doesn't migrate. It's called the mane, it's a paraphrase. There's different freshwater shrimps, a Tyre and a Triid, and they need separating from the Galaxius. And then there's a whole group of animals living in Tasmania which are really palearctic. They're called the very primitive amphipods. They're called phreatochids. Now they're weird. They'll live in an inch of mud and manure. It's basically an arthropod worm. They're just filter feeders. So they are great food of trout in Tasmania. So we'll be using them. And of course we'll be doing everything we can on the pond margin. This is system three, which we're trying to put in as many systems, not because we particularly want to grow more trout than, well, 10 or 20 acres of trout, but because we want to try out the system and find what are the sustainable trout growing systems. Nobody much has gone into fish forage, and yet it's wide open, mainly because we've analysed stomachs from 1880 on, and we know pretty well what the fish are into. So it's fairly easy to set up. The garlic there, that's ordinary garlic. I don't want to estimate the cost for you, but I don't think it'll be in excess of $300 to put it in. It costs $123. What it mostly costs is 90 hours a day breaking up the bloody bulbs into the clothes. And it cost us probably 3 weeks, I reckon it would be, hand planting it. An interesting thing is we thought we could work out a machine to plant it and a machine to harvest it. And as soon as we thought that, we knew we were trapped. What would have trapped us? No, we could have made it out of scrap off the system. It would have committed us to growing garlic. We would have been committed, and we've discovered better plants, a better return with far less input. for a crop like potatoes, how are you going to go back to a better system without folding up your money? Possibly. I doubt very much whether we could, because there are very few garlic growers in Tasmania. You possibly could. We figured, no, well, we'll put in that 3 weeks' worth because the risks are very low and the costs are low. And then we're not committed to garlic. We're only putting it in, really, to do some fencing and put the bags. Yeah, we can have, yeah, we can continue to proliferate along the path. Then we go to Russian now, which we do. See, we've got a lot of them along here. But, costs about, the price is about the same. And yet the bother of one is hardly anything, the bother of the other is about the same. An old beach pond. It's really quite acidic sand, about pH 4.5. We got them like that. Then the same fish we did with a dig. It's fairly obvious that if we make them much larger, more like small canals, oversize them, and then block all but maybe 3 inches of top, then we'll have a pond succession which is designed to run down to that trout pond. So we're going to re-dig all this. Did you see we've locked one there and put a pipe through it? So what you've got is quite a fishing drain, but it's also a long pond behind it. So we're going to re-dig these much deeper and much more major. Actually, it doesn't make much difference to the landscape. We just get drainage is a little more efficient. But this is of no use, particular use. You know, whereas this deep pond is just a use. If you dig ponds, you take a 13% chance. Oh, wait a minute, we'll wait for the mob here. Losing a golden bill. The only spring on the property was in that little clump of tea trees. And it seemed very logical to dig a pond below. The pond is never filled. Although it gets a lot of runoff. And the reason is there's a rock reef in the middle. And it's shattered. And most of the water out of this pond runs out down in there. We'll seal it up later by getting clay from here. Enlarging the pond and rolling across the rock river. In all the ponds you dig, take an Australian average, you'll get about 86%. So 13% will be dry for one or other reason. You can dig ponds in sites which don't look probable and very likely get there. Dry ponds have their use for silt, of course. They're used for storage places. You can garden. Putting a big one up above here, and that'll give us a fair head of water, about a 40-foot head. And that'll be the one we spend the most money on. We want the most... In fact, we wouldn't choose that at the site. It's our only choice to get ahead of it. Well, that's it. That's what I said to you. By choice, you wouldn't put a pond in. By choice, I'd rather put it on top of the hill where that comes out, but I don't own that. There's a good place to do it. Well, be careful of the accumulation of assets for a reason like some of them. Until you can handle this much sand, what's the point of it? Besides, you should look at that. Well, we should probably talk turkey with people, put the dam in. Yeah, that's been done. It's a young woman who owns it. She's always traveling from somewhere in Asia. We can't find her. Pardon? Should we what? Yeah, we'd probably be able to pull the dam in. We can pump the battery system from out from?
Yeah. 2019.
Yes, a considerable streamlet developed through that gap. There's a quite a large, if you go right back, you can see there's quite a large basin of runoff. We'll fill it up. Very little crop land in the pH is 4.5 here naturally in this pond. It's a natural acidity. We have put about a ton of that's not fine. Dolomite for acre. So we need to put a few tons to make much of it. No, it's not. I don't think it is, Andrew. I think originally I tested it. It's probably alkaline over against the sand. But it's acidic up in this point. That plus peat, that makes it a pretty good proposition for the blueberries and cranberries. Friend has just planted a hemp for 9,000 acres in far less. Oh yeah, this is a little problem which is quite nice to inherit. What's actually happening is there's a blackwood that's eating it if you give it time. But the locals never gave it time. They always burnt the gorse. And now we've got it, we can keep this clear line at the bottom. We've also keeping all the blackwoods we've got. The more blackwoods are coming through, you can see little ones coming through. We may plant more blackwoods. And we've got it full of wallabies. So we've got a modest stocking rate of wallabies. A few hundred, I guess.
How many?
A few hundred, I suppose.
A few hundred?
Wallabies.
Not in the egg?
I'm just sure. They come out all easy.
Yeah, in the egg?
Maybe 16, basically, roughly.
And you've got some hundreds of wallabies?
Yeah. Well, the wallabies aren't on the ancient. Wallabies are in here in cover, and in the summertime they move down into swamp. The wallabies are ranging out. If you'll notice, I don't know what you're
getting at. It's compared with seasonal growth crops, which
are actually seasonal without anything at all. Wallabies are far more return than cattle on this sort of country. There's a photo you can flash, and that's picture. And then you'll notice the tracks go right around the edge of the pond. Wallabies go right to the sand dunes from here. Right? So they graze over a fair area. They're a little bit of a nuisance. We've lost 4% of pines in the last year and a half. But they're not much of a nuisance. And they're highly productive. You could expect to get about $15 an animal. We used to get about that out of New York. I don't know what the skins are now. No, we sell the meat for well in the kitchen. All the meat here is easy.
What about they're killing it? Do you have to have a main inspector? What's all
it? You don't have to have a wallaby so far, but I did set it up. When I was killing it at Medina, I set it up with a health inspector and a design and built a process. Which pays. But we're not going to make a big thing out of that. Set up a killing ship?
Oh, yeah.
Well, possibly been a long tradition and you've never ceased it. The public is.
That's just the old lady. The Australian Conservation Foundation wants it. But the old lady is going to have it. It's 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 going to have it. No, they won't.
think that they are two slightly different populations, and you think we may be able to select for the double breeding population fairly well. And you can harvest at the same dates, or just after near the weaning dates. But the June, July, August animals have got very high quality pelt before you get that mottling of the mouth. And then the February born animals are not such a good animal. They don't weigh out as well as skin does. They're a little bit longer than they should. It's the wrong time of year to be born. Probably it would have referred to a historic time when we knew the present wind systems were reversed, when this was the dry part of Tasmania and the east coast was the wet part of Tasmania. It wasn't so long ago. In those days, it would have been advantageous for you to have bred in a different cycle. And probably what we're looking at is a population which was adapted to this different climatization. I don't know. We speculate a little bit about it. We've talked about it a lot. As to why that 13% double breed happened. Well, they're easy to harvest than almost anything else. You build a little scrap wood trap about 4 feet square with a fall down door and put a wooden treadle in. And normally you get 2 to 9 each trap wallabies. And you choose the least you'd expect. Pollard. You feed them. And they also use the traps for day and night rest. If you put the traps in quiet places and make them waterproof, they're in there most rainy days. So they use the trap as housing. The run day is when you want them, you set the trap, and you usually do 3 night rounds, so that from 20 traps, you usually take about 90 animals, would be what you'd expect. And you can't work more than 20 traps, because you can't really skin more than 90 animals. But that means that you can mark and release your breeding females, and your breeding history is very clear from the pouch. You can read the breeding history back maybe 2 years from the pouch. So you know whether you've got a double breeder or not. So you can ear tag those and let them all go. And then we would let the large proportion of single breeders go, and we'd kill all the rest, including most of the males, because there's 47% males in the natural population. You need about 7%. And when your males get much about 47%, they actually will kill the females by gang rape. Up to 18 males, a couple of them females. And sometimes they kill them. So you need to cull out a lot more of males than are culled out in the natural population. I've done a lot of observation of this on this site. Yeah. There's several saleable products from Wallaby. If you want to make some income. One of the very good products is sold in our future with a different age set for comparative physiology, particularly for dentist training dentistry. So there's a large biological supply cell. I used to supply it at one time, and biological supply cell. But I made more than sold in those days than I made in the field. And there's a large supply to embryology. And you can fix the reproductive system of wood. People like to look at marsupial reproductions in comparative embryology, or even in comparative physiology. So as a whole, there's nothing you need so much out of the wallaby I can think of except perhaps the gut. But you can mince it up and feed it to fish, providing a paunch out. I think poor drainage, and yes, the salt out of the hill, and there's a lot of salt comes onshore. But I think the salt causes acidity, it causes alkaline, Also, all of these are old beach rocks. You can see the sand here in this field. And that goes right around this inlet here. This is an old inlet. If you look carefully at the landscape here, you'll see five very well-defined levels of sea sandstone. The most recent is a recession of 12 feet. And this part of Tasmania is tilting up, and the south is tilting down. Therefore, towards the east and south, you'll see ground rivers. Up here, you'll see raised coastal platforms. That was very late in the 1800s. So even if sea levels are rising, this is catastrophic rising. We're trying to keep up. you see, 5 major levels of sea standstill, and the top one is the top of the Green Hills. It's all seaplane, it's all folded in. And then there's this one here, which is this shelf down below. And when you come down, you can see them all in different profiles. And all our pebbles are sea washed. Also, it's not so long back that it was up here, but it's been up here twice in the last 18,000 years. So every sea line here has Aboriginal litters. Everywhere we dig on an old sandstill line, we've got litters. And so when we're doing these, that's another thing I should perhaps have pointed out to you when you're earth moving, to keep your archaeological eye out. Because we've found several living sets we've been able to save. Also, down here in the clay, in that pond over there, 15 feet down, we found black bearded rocks, which have obviously been knocked down as a sea rose, and then the clay's been formed over the top of them. And they're very well preserved. And they go up to 20 feet down in the clay. And the rose is the black bearded. So you can do a little bit of historical, what's the word, dendrology. Dendrochronology. You can do a little bit of past climate if you keep your eye out and salvage those materials. If you just bulldoze them, you can destroy more than you really create. So there's all sorts of aspects to earth moving which we'll get into later in the course. But I want to see it on here. I've finished. Now, what I'm suggesting to you, you know what we're doing on here at the Commonwealth Library, right? Except for that corner over there, which can be cultivated. Ours is the other side of this cloud field. The green is ours, right? How many living can we get off this land? How many people can we involve? What service industries would we develop and what process? And I won't ask you how to capitalise on the so, if you've got any brilliant ideas about a single living, we will, tonight or tomorrow morning perhaps, we'll just a free association trot it out. Doesn't that sound ridiculous? What's the way to make a living? I mean, if it sounds absolutely ridiculous, I feel it's quite a good living rearing small aquarium. It's one of the highest aquatic inputs, I tell you, that they do. Minus whatever. We've designed the hell out of here. You just might spring a surprise. Two years ago, that girl got the pistol with the pest. This year it's done. That's the one year. This year it's a valuable medicinal. Well, it no longer is. Okay. The third soil is the cause of thistles. If we can
cap it off,
disturbing the soil, the thistles do go out. Well, I've finished for the day, so I'm going to... No, not right here there, isn't it? That's closed.
Go along here and make your way up through there, okay?
You can go and have a look at the cricket pitch pond, which is out on there if you so want to. You go and feel the play and run off. Make sure it's there. Walk around the swamp, you can contemplate, you can do what you like. How many livings could we place on this land? How many families could we have? Let's knock the eels out of the pond in terms of best estimate. And allow yourself 40 acres of water.
You're going to be sort of fishing food
too? No, obviously that's not. I'm going to leave it to you while I sit here ringing bells and having cigarettes. You can go and have a little closer look at the land, and then I can answer some questions for you in the morning, if you have questions in your mind. I'll go climb. And my client, now, what the client's instructions are simple. The land is in public trust. The aim is to employ as many people as possible and to establish the first Commonwealth system in Australia. Therefore, we want to see how many people can make a living off aviation. And I include primary production, processing and services. And for the town at large. The population of the town is 560, most of whom are fairly poor. Many of them are single parents or old girls and children. Only one employment situation in town, a small sawmill. Otherwise, it's all hard post on the shelf. There's your job. Anything else you want to know from the client? What I want is maximum production of living. As many people to make a living off here as possible, and which is safe to make. Under an organic and sustainable agriculture. Okay, now I'm going to sit down and have a